I'm Ryan Jeffrey, and this is the Passionate About OSS podcast. We have episode number 3 today. So there are many different roles, skills, and techs in OSS, but there are only a few recruiters who really help fill these roles in a specialized nature. So today's guest is a practice principal at Analytica, who specialize in OSS BSS, but also telco, cloud, and IT. So welcome today to Michael Jones.
Good evening, Ryan. How are you?
Very good, thank you. So you've been with Analytica for around 8 years, Michael. Where was your entry into this this industry that we are so passionate about?
Well, you might actually laugh. It was actually sitting on a beach in India.
That's the obvious place to find OSS resources, right?
Well, exactly. But reached a point, I was 29, had been traveling, teaching English abroad for a number of years. And as much fun as it had been, you lived like a rock star. Whenever the ESL scene was obviously international, you could get jobs all around the world. But it was never something that you would develop too much in. I didn't see it as a long-term career. It was a great way, especially just after the recession hit in late 2008. It was a great way to see the world, get paid to do so, and pick up a little bit of experience in different cultures and different mindsets, I suppose. But at that point, I reached a point and decided it was time to set up a career, time to do something different.
Sounds really, really interesting. So the teaching English as a language, did that actually help you potentially in the role that you're doing now? That you have many English as a second language type applicants?
Certainly. What I do find is I think everybody, especially when you're speaking with candidates for whom English isn't necessarily the first language, and you hear almost, especially in an office environment, you can hear people putting on an accent. You don't need to change the way you don't need to change what you say. Sometimes it's more of a case of changing how you say it. So keeping the language a little bit more simple, yes. Remembering that not everybody speaks at 100 miles an hour, especially like a Welshman. I actually started on the same day as a colleague. He was he's Turkish, but lived in London for a number of years. We were both speaking at 100 miles an hour. We quickly learned that that wasn't the way to do things. So I think it's helped you to adapt. It's helped you to understand it from a candidate or a client's perspective and to change the way that you speak and communicate accordingly.
Yeah, and even perhaps living in their countries as well, and the experiences that they have, you get to see an insight into, I guess, the upbringing and the cultures and things that are different to perhaps where you were brought up in.
Yeah. I mentioned India, obviously very hectic, very colourful. I always like to call it an attack on the senses because there's noise, there's the most wonderful, delightful food, everything, the scenery, but it's 100 miles an hour. Korea, very similar. I taught English there for a couple of years. But again, what was interesting, and I think what brought me, I suppose, a little bit into the tech space was seeing how far ahead the likes of Korea and Japan were even then. Several of the technologies that they'd adopted in the late 2000s, they were a couple of years ahead of the UK. So it was always interesting coming back for your fortnight off or a month off and realizing how far behind we actually were.
Yeah, so you did actually seek out specifically the tech industry to join in recruitment?
It was certainly something I was interested in. Interestingly, unfortunately, given current circumstances, I actually had an offer from another company that was actually focused around travel recruitment. So obviously, having spent many years abroad, was also very interested and passionate about travel and did like the idea and the concept of being able to recruit and visit these people in far-flung places. But given coronavirus and what's happened over in 2020 worldwide, I think I made the right choice.
Yeah, and certainly in hindsight, you could have never predicted that 8 years ago though.
How could anyone predict what's around the corner?
Indeed. So tell us a little bit about Analytica and its niches. So I know you really, through OSS recruitment and the roles that you publish on LinkedIn in particular, but I'm sure Analytica does a lot more than that.
Yeah, exactly. I think back in 2005, when it was founded, it was actually two executives who founded it back then, and they wanted to focus within OSS purely. They did a lot of work with what was Kramer and became Amdocs, obviously, and then partnered up with Ericsson as they were looking to establish their consulting and systems integration practice, and made a business off the back of that, I suppose you'd say. As technology has evolved, I mean, I came in 2012, was initially focused around the service fulfillment piece. There were a lot of changes at that time. I then quickly sort of moved onto the BSS, the billing, rating, charging, mediation side of things. And I'd say, although that's been my core focus since, essentially, as tech has evolved, so have we. So in the last few years, you're seeing my sweet spot, I suppose you'd say, would be the telecoms and tech sales piece. So it's not purely the OSS, BSS, but I still consider that to be my baby. I still consider that to be home.
Yeah, and I probably am the same. So I refer to OSS, but really it's I conflate OSS, BSS, and telco to a large extent, just because OSS touches it all, but it's just easier to say OSS than the other, all those other words I just mentioned. So tell us a little bit about Analytica. What sort of size are you now? The number of people who work there, the number of people that you place each year, if you have those stats available?
Well, we're a small company. Obviously, last year was a challenging period. We still made a number of placements worldwide and a couple of interesting ones, which I'd like to discuss a little bit later. Yeah. But we're typically talking about the 40-50 range on a yearly basis.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so quite niche. And I guess that's the interesting thing about this industry, that it seems quite niche, but obviously it covers a really broad set of skills. So I assume you cover a lot of the placement types, all the way from execs, devs, architects, PMs, and so much more.
Yeah, so myself, I will focus primarily within the sales and pre-sales space nowadays. Yep. I have a colleague who he does a lot more of the senior leadership hires because of the network that he's gained over several years with the likes of, I think, Ericsson I mentioned there, Hewlett-Packard as well. He's got a much broader network of those senior leadership types of people. My roles will range from, I suppose you talk, you know, regional sales directors, business development managers, all the way up to regional VPs, sometimes even global VPs of sales.
Okay. Who would be the ideal customers? Well, I guess first question is who you consider the customers. So I guess you've got the applicant side as well as the employer side as well, and who the ideal customers are that you look for.
Well, as I mentioned, we have worked with these larger companies, the larger SIs and operators, but I think the personal sweet spot, and again, I think working for the smaller company myself gives you that insight. I think it would be these small and medium-sized telecom vendors. There's two reasons for that I tend to find. One is the processes tend to be a lot quicker. There is a war on talent worldwide at the moment, and the companies that react the quickest and are able to expedite processes where necessary to attract that best talent, they're the ones who do well. We have worked with companies previously where the interview process can sometimes be quite torturous. There's long gaps in between interviews, whether it's a phone to a face-to-face, and even getting the feedback can be a challenge sometimes. And I think that's somewhere that these smaller and mid-sized companies can be a little bit more agile. They can make decisions quickly. We've even seen sometimes where one phone call, you'll get a phone call from the hiring manager and they'll say, you know what, we actually think that this person's the one, but we still need to go through the process.
Yeah, really valid point too, because I guess you hear the horror stories of the 9 interviews and 2.5 months later, but the really talented people don't last on the market that long, if they were ever even on the market.
We had one process, and it was a colleague of mine who, I think it was 13 interviews which took place. And then eventually the CEO had decided that he personally didn't like the candidate. There was some potential issue in terms of just gelling. You know how it works sometimes. Yeah, yeah. And the CEO had said, exactly, the CEO had said to the hiring manager, look, personally, it's a no from me, but if you want to hire him, go ahead. Well, it's very difficult to go against the word of the CEO, isn't it? That process fell by the wayside. We've also had a process that took 11 months. Now, this is too much. When there's candidates being snapped up within a week, 2 weeks of becoming available, you can understand the problem.
There's a lot to get your head around in the space as well. So the fact that you narrow it down on sales is helps a little. Certainly there would be a lot of dimensions to finding really good candidates. So, like even the best of the best resources that I've come across take time to become productive. So how do you find the best fit candidates in amongst all of that information overload and undoubtedly the long list of applicants that you have?
Firstly, it's all about your talent pool, knowing your market. One thing that we're constantly doing is updating our contact database, if you like, and that talent pool, engaging. I think LinkedIn plays a part, but also check-ins, whether something's changed, whether somebody's life circumstances have changed. They may no longer want to travel, for example. They may have learned a new technology that you weren't aware of. So there's keeping abreast of your candidates is one. But secondly, knowing what makes your candidate tick. I think I mentioned above that some candidates, they will thrive in a larger company. They like to have the processes. They like to have everything ready for them and to work off the brand that they're representing. There's other candidates, especially in sales, who are very autonomous. They like to work on their own. They will get in front of customers and they get things done very autonomously, if you like. So. It's knowing the individual. It's knowing what makes them tick. That goes way beyond what you will see in a CV, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And even getting an understanding of the culture of the company that you're hiring into them, I imagine you spend some time understanding whether they are the good fit. So I've noticed that having been lucky enough to work at large and small organizations, there is a vastly different way of working within them.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing, and that would possibly be something as a tip for an OSS employer, would be to develop that relationship with a niche recruiter that does understand the market beyond, like I say, the CVs or the keywords, but also to allow access to a hiring manager. You would be amazed how much more successful our recruitment processes are when you get a 20, 30 minute call with a hiring manager. To really dig deeper and understand what they want beyond keywords, beyond the job description, you can learn so much off that phone call.
And do you tend to find a lot of the successful applicants have come from the database as opposed to reaching out with job ads? Because I'd imagine you'd have thousands of responses to the ads you put out.
Yeah, exactly. And that was something else that is very true here. I was actually looking at some of our placements previously this year, and they have come from network. It's people that we've known or referrals. The problem that you find with job boards, I mean, we use LinkedIn as part of our employer branding, of course, or to be able to get out there, but we don't really put a great deal of stock in terms of those job posts, because you're probably looking at 5% of those candidates, I'd say, being relevant. It takes a lot of our time, and you're not getting the best qualified candidates. They will invariably be the passive ones who aren't even looking for a change at this time.
Yep. Absolutely. I found that to be quite the case as well. And I guess there are quite a lot of other recruitment firms these days that do things by volume. So it's all about the speed of getting things through. But it sounds like you spend a lot more time thinking and getting to know the people on both sides of the equation.
Exactly. And it's that depth of relationship that allows you not to skip the queue, but I would certainly say that if you're a candidate in this market, you should be looking, again, like an employer, you should be looking for the niche recruiters. They're the ones that will invariably have the relationships, and you've proven that in terms of the candidates that you put across. If you look at some of the higher volume agencies, like you mentioned, it is all about getting CVs straight across. I'd rather take a few days longer, really speak to and have that deeper level of knowledge, and the interview ratio speaks for itself.
Yeah, so I guess I've never been directly in recruiting, but I've worked alongside some recruiters through the consulting firms I've worked with in the past, and I found that very much to be true. The difference in the success rates between the people who took the time and put the effort, they're potentially a little bit slower, but the results seem to be so much more successful just on numbers from my external view.
Absolutely. And I think something that we're seeing in the market increasingly, and we've been asked a couple of times recently as well, is to engage on an exclusive or a retained basis. The problem you're getting with contingent is people will have a quick scan of the database, see what's available, get CVs across. They're not really putting that legwork in. You can customize an offering so much more if you know you've got the buy-in from an employer. And you know that if you put the legwork in and you actually spend the time to really dig deep, you will get a result. You're going to get 100% of that recruiter's time, which on contingent, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess in the area of OSS that I've tended to work more in, which has been more the consulting and technology aspects of it, I've found that I become more valuable the longer I spend with a company. So in terms of getting to know the tribal knowledge, their ways of working and so forth, I guess it would be the same in terms of your customers, in terms of your employers that you work with. You get a better understanding of the way they work and who fits within their organization. So kind of having that longer term relationship would fit that really well too.
Absolutely. I think it works two ways. You get to know how what makes an employer tick. You also get to understand the culture, how processes work. When you're able to detail an interview process with confidence to a candidate, the brand perception becomes so much better. You actually become a lot more consultative in terms of your advice to a client. When you're able to engage and provide a little bit more insight, you're not just providing a CV, you're actually becoming a little bit more entrenched within their hiring processes.
Yeah, okay. And from the applicant side of things, do you have any tips to make the applicants stand out above all others, given that there are usually quite a few people in the funnel for any given job? What are the kind of things they should do more of?
Well, one thing I'd always say, read the job description in detail. As we mentioned above, with some of these LinkedIn jobs, people will do one click apply, which is fine. if that's what you choose to do, and that's something that you find successful, understandable. But at the same time, from a recruitment perspective, it doesn't make you stand out. And very often what you find with LinkedIn as well is if it's an out of country application, it will be archived automatically. So you will almost disappear to the bottom of the queue. So from a candidate perspective, I always enjoy when you receive your connection request or you receive an email and a bit of an intro and even picking up the phone, you know, let me know about you. Because ultimately it's making yourself memorable, making yourself stand out from the piles of CVs or these applications that come in. I'm going to remember the person who does something different, like picks up the phone now. It's amazing how things have changed in the last 8 years.
And particularly in the tech industry, I guess that's true. But it surprises me a little bit, given that you're dealing with a lot of sales roles. I would have thought that's just almost a given trait to make a call and try and introduce yourself and so forth.
You see it more so in sales, to be fair. I will give you that. But at the same time, I think that there is this culture, I suppose, of rather than cold calling, and I think everybody's guilty of it, you try and establish a connection before picking up the phone.
Yes. And how do you identify the skills, the traits and so forth of who will be a good fit? Because you'll have a number of different people coming through. There's no real apples for apples comparison for any person who's applying. So I'd love to find out more about how you actually conduct that process and find the best fit.
Talking. That's the one. Within sales, you will know what you're selling. You will know who you've sold to. You will know your figures. Ultimately, any candidate or any CV where you see that information stand out instantly, the person has got the confidence to wear their network proudly, to wear their figures and their quota proudly. That's always going to stand out. In terms of on the more technical side, some of the skills that were very popular, say, 7-8 years ago, they've become pretty much obsolete. So I think we're also looking for candidates who they've shown that willingness to learn. I love it when I see on LinkedIn that candidates have picked up a new certification or they've said that they're going to learn a new, even a LinkedIn course, for example. It's always having that curiosity to learn. That's something that we enjoy doing at Analytica. I'm not a technical expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I do spend a good amount of time reading, especially your blog, Ryan, and trying to understand a little bit deeper what I'm recruiting for.
Yeah, okay. That's a really interesting perspective because I also put great value in that learning process and spend a lot of time on it. But I would have never thought of really putting a certification up there. I notice them pop in on LinkedIn as people put them on the feed regularly. But I hadn't taken that perspective that you've just given there. So that's great.
I think within sales as well, you see a large change towards a sort of more consultative selling style, being able to work alongside customers. The days of the transactional sale have moved on. Clients are a lot more, demanding. They want you to stand out and they want to understand that you understand them.
Yes. Yeah, a really strong believer in that too. I guess that transition, in my mind at least, from the push selling to more of a pull selling or pull marketing type model where the cold calling model hasn't really worked, and OSS being so big and complex tend to need quite a consultative level of engagement anyway.
Exactly. And I think following on from that is the listening skills as well. And sometimes I'm guilty, especially I think one of the challenges with video calling or the Zoom that we're having at the moment is interrupting or jumping, but at the same time it's taking that time to really listen. Everybody does.
It's a really valid point. It's something I struggle with too, and I tend to find a lot of the really clever people that I come across are so willing to share their information and their ideas that perhaps we do need to take a step back a little bit at times and listen more thoroughly. I know I have to try and force myself to it and get so passionate about this industry that end up chattering away. Yeah, a really, really valid point. So with some of the candidates, I guess they come from various different levels depending on the roles. Do you tend to find that the personal relationships you have with them, do you tend to mentor them through the process?
Yeah. I think we do that from the outset. You're going to have different candidates, some of them whereby they will do their own thing and you will try. You will offer every candidate the same level of attention. I'm a big firm believer of having that longer conversation initially, really getting to grips and understanding what is going to make this candidate tick, what they're going to be looking for, but also every step of the process, every step of the interview process, you'll have a pre-brief, you'll have a debrief. Any information that you can glean from that, of course, you might be able to pass on to any further candidates in the process. But you want to feel that that candidate trusts you. You want to know that that candidate knows that you've got their best interests at heart. We're all here to make money, but ultimately, it is ultimately about the candidate and that they leave any process, even if the process ends up being negative in terms of they don't get the job, but they know that you've done your best.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've looked a little bit about applicants. What about some tips for the OSS employers, BSS employers? Any tips for guiding them through the process?
Be quick. As I mentioned, it is really a war on talent nowadays. If you look at some of the trends coming through, particularly on the sort of cloud, the analytics, machine learning side of things, a lot of these candidates who are actually upskilling, who are keeping up to date with new requirements, they're being snapped up like that very quickly. I think the other thing to mention is engaging five or six or multiple agencies doesn't increase an employer's chance of filling the job. Ultimately, the same people will be fighting for what is a relatively small pool of talent, don't get me wrong. But I think if you engage with a specialist, as I mentioned there, the passive markets is what gives you access to the best talent. Job boards or a spray and pray approach doesn't work. Really understand what you want from your hire and partner with a specialist to go out and get it.
Yeah, so that's a fantastic perspective on things. Are there any other myths about the industry that you'd like to debunk? Any contrarian views you may have from what outsiders might mention?
Well, I think I've mentioned a little earlier in terms of the work that goes into talent pool development, if you like, or staying abreast of candidates, what they're looking to do. You know, we don't just send CVs and hope. There's a lot more work that goes into it. And I think that, admittedly, not everybody is as detailed. And there are some great recruiters out there. There are some terrible recruiters out there. But in the same way that there are some great workers within the OSS space and some fantastic names worldwide, you're also going to have your nightmare stories. People are people. Not everybody's perfect. So it's remembering that recruiters are out there to do a job as well. And it's in our interests that the process is as quick and as swift as possible. We're not looking to slow things down or to be awkward. We're looking to be thorough and make sure that the candidate who goes in to the employer stays there for the long term and adds value.
I guess, too, it's a small enough pool that there is some blacklisting, whitelisting based on past experiences, either directly or word of mouth that you get through. So doing the right thing, whether that's candidate side or employer side, must come up out of that too, I imagine.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, a couple of great examples over the last year. There was a candidate that I've been in contact with since 2012, who we've been in touch every 6 months or so. Turns out he was actually on the market and looking just at the right time. So it's maintaining that relationship and being able to, I think sometimes what we tend to do internally is, right, this candidate's on the market. What do you think? Where would be good? Knowing your network from an employer's perspective, but also knowing the candidates well, it's about depth of relationship. It's about listening. It's about building, ultimately. And I think the key thing that you build there is trust, both from a candidate and an employer's perspective.
And I guess in terms of my experience, at least, is ensuring that you stay front of mind. So would that be something else that you would recommend to candidates, is doing that and staying in touch every 6 months, that person obviously was reaching out on a regular basis and you developed a strong rapport over that 8 year period?
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to be for a specific role. It's, again, like you say, to stay front of mind. You might be very happy in your role, but you might want to hear an insight. You might want to have a quick 15-minute catch-up. Anything can change at any time. Anybody can change a job. A company can be acquired. There can be any myriad of factors which change circumstances. Somebody might have a child and not be able to travel anymore. Everything can change, but what constant and what regular contact allows us to do is to build up a picture in terms of what that candidate looks like, in terms of what the perfect opportunity is going to look like.
So in any given day, what sort of split would you give to resource acquisition? Because you're covering a number of different bases. You're curating and expanding the current network and database. You're headhunting, you're engaging with applicants. Yeah, how do you find that balance, and what is that sort of balance? Where would you spend most of your time?
Well, that depends on the number of active roles that you've got at any given time. An element of our work, of course, is speculative selling. So if you were to, example, get a great candidate in, and again, this comes from knowing your network, if a candidate becomes available, you will spend time contacting prospective employers, whether they're employers that you work with already or whether they're people that you would like to work with. You will spend time doing that. So that's one element. Two, social media plays a bigger part than ever before.
And do you use primarily LinkedIn in that space, or are there other channels that you use as well?
In terms of social media, I think LinkedIn is a very powerful tool, and it is actually misunderstood. In terms of my industry, possibly less so on specific developer-type roles where there are different hangouts and different groups, and recruiters who specialize in those areas will have a different perspective to mine. However, in terms of sales and pre-sales, certainly, I think LinkedIn remains the primary tool. What you'll find yourself doing, obviously, there's elements of contacting candidates on LinkedIn, always looking to expand the pool, always looking for in any industry news, or there's a number of automations on there which allow you to realize that, oh, this company seems to be letting a lot of people go, or this company appears to have hired X, Y, and Z recently. you've just got to have your ears and eyes open and always looking for what's next.
And how do you put the categorization or filters out there? Is it on technologies? Is it on skills? Is it on seniority of roles?
Good question. I think there's an element of both. You can tag candidates specifically, but also you can follow companies. And I think that's the main one that I tend to find. Following the companies gives you that information into your feed on a regular basis. You can always go digging then within, but also groups seem to have become en vogue once again in LinkedIn. That's always a valuable source as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I've looked at some of the OSS specific groups on LinkedIn and found that they haven't had a lot of dialogue appearing there. And as a result, I guess I haven't paid much attention over the last 6 months or so to many of the groups, except when a notification pops in. So it's interesting. You feel like that's trending up at the moment.
Yeah, I would say so. I'd certainly say so. Although, I mean, I'm talking about, personally, my network would be around 25,000 connections. So a lot of that would still be, look, it's sharing news. It's actually interacting with people on a feed basis as well. So, yes, the groups play a part, but they're not the be-all and end-all. I think it's a combination of everything.
Yeah. So your network's 25,000. I didn't realize that LinkedIn allowed you to get up to that many. Is that just purely because of your role as a recruiter and the tools that you use with LinkedIn from that perspective?
Yeah, exactly. So that obviously you will send out connection requests, perhaps to people who are specific to your network. And that's another tip would always be to personalize. If you establish relevance and you say, look, I'm a recruiter in your space, I've been working in this space for 8 years, very rarely is somebody not going to connect with you. But at the same time, if you blindly click connect and somebody doesn't know the reason why, well, what are you gaining out of it? What is the value add to you?
Yeah, because just that little bit of time to make that connection and the dialogue, if you're getting bombarded with it, yeah, I can see the point why people would turn away those connection requests without any commentary. What other trends are you really noticing through the industry? You talked a little bit about cloud and analytics earlier on. What other things are you really seeing as trending up and down, for that matter?
Customer experience seems to be becoming a huge thing. MVNO seems to be leading the charge on that, really engaging with their customers. And the operators that are able to crack that will have much lower levels of churn and actually happier customers. If you think about some of your interactions with your operator, your personal operator, do they deliver the service that you want?
Yeah, it's a fascinating call out too, because I think I may have even mentioned in one of the earlier podcasts that I probably have around a much smaller network than yours, but around 2,500 people in the OSS industry. And yet I only know two who really specialize in CX and UX, and I feel like it's a real gap in both the tools we produce, but also to an extent the processes. I guess there's lots of really, really competent BAs I've worked alongside who helped that along, but particularly in the tool design and the portal design and so forth, it seems to be a real gap in the industry. So it's great to hear that there is that's trending upwards.
Certainly. And I think it's logical, isn't it? If you're happier with the engagement that you get, you're more likely to stick with your operator. I mean, I had a horror story about a year and a half ago, which led me to change. I'm not going to go into too much details or name the customer, but I think the Welsh tend to be very brand loyal, for example. Well, probably true of the UK as a whole. We don't like to change. It's a hassle. It's a fiddle. So it takes a lot to annoy me.
Yeah, I mean, even just the people who do reach out to the telcos tend to only reach out because there's a problem or there's something that needs urgent attention. Generally, most people would tend to self-serve where they can. And yet, I find it really interesting the focus on IVR, where it's looking to just push people back onto online or to basically avoid contact centres in many cases. So, yeah, it's... I do find it really interesting the way that the telco industry has treated people in the past. But yeah, it's exciting to hear that there's an upward trend on CX.
Absolutely. But again, I mean, leading on from that, obviously, it's being able to analyze and understand subscriber behavior. Obviously, data monetization is going to be key. And that's one of the challenges that I think a lot of operators still haven't solved. But ultimately, I think that comes from having that subscriber knowledge and understanding their behaviors and being able to provide those tailored solutions accordingly.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting crossover point as well between the sales that you were talking earlier and the CX, because I tend to find that because that's the only way that people interact with their telcos in many cases is via the contact center, that the contact center isn't more of the best and the brightest that they've got, and that it is ensuring that NPS scores are up, that people are satisfied, but also the potential to upsell through that experience and not just the cheap and cheesy and I guess checklist based upsell, but really finding out about the customer. And yet that seems to be contra to the way the industry handles things at the moment.
Going back to the consultative selling, you're not trying to just sell something for the sake of it. It's understanding your customer.
Yeah, oh, really valid point. All right, so we talked about some of the things that are trending upwards. What are the things that are trending downwards that are losing relevance? You talked about the massive change over the 7 or 8 years that those skills are no longer relevant. But, yeah, perhaps some insights into what those are and what people should be wary of to try and upskill themselves and make themselves more relevant.
Well, it's quite interesting within telco. I think, you know, 7, 8 years ago, you were talking very much, I think Siebel was preeminent from the CRM perspective. Some massive deployments going on in the Siebel space. And I actually, one of my missions when I actually started working was mainly around the Oracle stack, for example, the likes of OSM, AIA, BRM, for example, but also Siebel, was to really grow my network in that space. What I actually quickly found, though, was that people were moving away.
Yes.
So I spent a long time talking to people and they were like, yeah, that's great. A recruiter's contacted me about this.
Yeah.
But I was building my network. I wasn't really contacting with specific roles in mind. So it was a little rabbit hole, should we say. I mean, yeah, there were some large deployments in sort of 2013, 14, but it sort of moved away since then. I mean, Salesforce has become the preeminent CRM,
yes,
for example. But also, if we look at the likes of roaming, there's big changes happening and big changes afoot there.
Yeah, really interesting. And I guess through that transition, as you help people transition through phases of the career, you must have come across quite a lot of human interest stories. Are there any anecdotes that stand out for you?
Yeah, well, there's one in particular. It was actually out in Malaysia. I was actually contacted into inbound by a Syrian who'd actually unfortunately been forced to move as a result of the ongoing war at the time. He landed in Malaysia, required sponsorship, and was just looking for a job. He was one of the nicest guys I've ever spoken to, very humble, and literally just wanted to work. You know, he wasn't as first in terms of the role itself. But he was very talented from a Java development perspective. And this wouldn't really be my core, quite frankly. But it was one of those people that you just want to help. So we very quickly contacted our network and actually did some, I'd say, speculative selling, but with a massively reduced fee. Because we weren't really looking to profit from this guy. We just wanted to get him into a job. And very luckily, and it's probably I think it is the lowest fee that I've made in my recruitment career. Got me a few beers, but look, he was happy. He was in. This was a guy whose life had been turned upside down. And within about, I think, 4 to 6 weeks, we'd actually managed and secured with a job, somebody that we keep in touch with to this day.
Fantastic. And I guess with many things, it's the foot in the door. I know trying to find my very first job out of uni, it was probably 50 applications before I found one. And so it is all about that foot in the door. So it's fantastic that you're giving people like that coming from difficult circumstances the opportunity to get the foot in the door. So is that one of the things that still excites you? You've been in the industry for nearly a decade now. What is it that still inspires you, and what makes you most excited to get out of bed in the morning and come back from your holiday break and get back into it?
A couple of things, really. I think 2 days are never the same. You're speaking to people, and people have got different drivers. People have got different experiences. People have got different outlooks on life. One of the things that aforementioned a few years abroad gave me was what I think is an ability to chat rubbish with anyone. you heard this at the top of our call. So, you know, it's having an interest in people. I actually live about 100 meters away from the beach in North Wales. We still have our office in central London, and we meet up every couple of weeks. Well, we were meeting up every couple of weeks pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the concept of having a North Walian sat with a laptop and a webcam and a phone. And you can talk to anyone all over the world. I find it absolutely fantastic. And when you actually talk to people and they ask what you do, you're talking to people. It's not rocket science. It really isn't. Having an interest in people, you can tell. You can just tell with people, ultimately. If you enjoy what you're doing, I hope I do. I still think I do.
It seems to come across, yeah.
Exactly. But it's, like I say, showing an interest, having a hook. And I think the hook, ultimately, whether it's sports, whether it's, oh, you're from there, oh, I've been there, oh, I've traveled there, whatever. Very often on LinkedIn, it's pints of Guinness, for example. different things drive different people, and it is a people business, and it's that experience that's at the heart. And if you can look after people, if you can be very open and transparent, not every process will go to plan. People might not get hired. That is the way it is, unfortunately. But as long as you've done your best, as long as you have been open and transparent with people, you'll generally get people coming back to you.
Mm-hmm. So one really important call out there. I spotted that you said Guinness over LinkedIn. Gee, those LinkedIn recruiter resources must be a whole lot better than the rest of us get. You can share a Guinness over LinkedIn.
I meant the photos. But no, it's been one of the, especially over COVID, where the brief time that we were allowed out, I've got a lovely golf club just down the road, and having a pint there overlooking the beach, there's nothing like it after a day's work. Certainly not after a Friday's work, in case my boss is listening.
So not wasting time actually hitting any golf balls, just watching other people do it.
I've tried to play, Ryan. I'm absolutely rubbish. How about yourself?
Yeah, I love to play the game, but time just doesn't permit so much anymore, unfortunately. So, a full day out on a Saturday or whatever, five hours to play a round of golf is a bit of a struggle, but I do love the game and would love to get out there more. So you also talked about the people, and interacting with people is a real passion of yours, clearly. So is that one of the best ways that you find of staying abreast of all the changes in this industry? Because one of the things I've found is even the best of the best don't know everything there is to know about the industry and the massive changes that are going on in it. Is that one of your best resources, or do you tend to do a lot of reading and research as well?
A little bit of both. Look, again, as I mentioned, we are far away from being technical experts. You know, we don't claim to be, but it's, what I'll often do is lay myself bare and say, look, this isn't an area that I know a great deal about. Tell me.
Explain to me, yeah.
Yeah, and it's having that, again, that bit of curiosity. And as long as you know enough, and as long as you have that curiosity to learn, if people are, you will find on phone calls, if you over the course of a month have heard X 5 or 6 times, well, hold on a minute, I need to go and do some digging. I need to go and do some research on this.
And similarly, I guess, do you develop the BS filter or the BS radar type skills to pick when people don't know what it is that they're talking about exactly, but are really good with all the jargon and buzzwords?
I'm sure a few have said that about me. however, no, I think you do. I think, look, ultimately, you can tell when the wool's being pulled over your eyes. I've had situations where somebody might have an excellent sales network, but if they haven't sold within the OSS space or the BSS space, mm. oh yeah, well, I've done a bit of that, or yeah, we did that. Have you? What have you solved? Mm. You know, it's, you have to drill down or sometimes ask the same question two or three times slightly differently to get to the answer. But ultimately, what we don't want to do, we never want a situation whereby you will submit a candidate, for example, and they'll get found out at interview stage. It's a waste of the candidate's time. It's a waste of your time. And it's above all, it's a waste of the client's time. So, you know, we like to be transparent, and very often we'll spend a lot of time ruling candidates out. And it's not that we don't want the candidate to be a good fit. Of course I do. It makes my, if I could get three candidates perfect for a job and send them straight away, that would make my life a lot easier.
More time down at that golf course / pub.
Well, exactly. But life isn't always like that. But again, this comes from the network, and it's actually the amount of times where a job will come up, and we'll always have a little conflag between us in terms of, okay, this has come up. Who do you think might be a good fit? Right, that guy's done that. That guy's done that. Or he's, this guy's an expert with AT&T, for example. Mm. Well, next minute, you know, it's having that conversation between you. It's having that network. But that's network that has spent years in the making. So it's not just something that you can't just go on LinkedIn, click on a profile and say, yeah, that's perfect. I suppose you could, but that's going to be a very lucky find.
Yeah, and you raise a really valid point there too, that by trying to pull the wool over the recruiter's eyes or over the employer's eyes, that if you do get found out, whether it's at the recruitment process or whether it's in the job, effectively you're wasting your time and others. But I guess there are a lot of people out there who are really keen to find work and looking to get their foot in the door too.
It's a real difficult one, and especially over the course of the last year. I mean, something that I was trying to do, and I know that other candidates were offering similar, other recruiters were offering similar services on LinkedIn. You would take time and be honest and say, look, unfortunately, this isn't necessarily my core niche, or I don't have the network so much in this area. You would find yourself, you would refer them to recruiters that might be better placed to help, for one. But B, take some time to optimize the CV. Really make the CV stand out. You might not be able to find them a job, but as long as you can help somebody along the way, then that's part of the job as well. And it was also in that situation of the community coming together, and I think a worldwide community in that regard, just trying to do something to help.
Actually, it's a really good point. It brings back a memory of of my very first job. I went to a recruiter and he said, all right, you need to do this, this, and this. And I said, well, I can do one or two of those, and I know I can grow into these other things, but I just don't have the background in X, Y, Z. And he said, oh, just make it up. Just say you have. I said, no. That's not the way this is going to happen. I'm not going to put blatant lies on an application. But sure enough, I got the job, and that was the foot in the door that started everything else. So,
okay.
Glad that there aren't too many of those out there in the industry. But funny anecdote.
Ethics make the man. But look, I mean, the result ended okay for you, but I'm not sure moving forward that, you know, that would be the best practice to adopt. If it works, it works.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many other people he placed into that role using the same recommendations, but no, I certainly wasn't going to go that way.
You just touched on something there, though, I think is interesting, and perhaps employers should be a little bit more cognizant and receptive too, is the ability to learn on the job. I mean, nearly 9 years later, I'm still learning on the job. But at the same time, if you have got a large amount of the skill set required for a particular role and are able to demonstrate that you've picked up new technologies quickly, that is something else that actually can reduce the time to hire. I mean, it might take slightly longer to become productive, but if the person's showing enough skills and talent in terms of acquiring new technologies or to be able to pick things up, then that's also something to consider.
Yeah, I mean, especially because we're in an industry that is implementation or sales or any aspects of it, there's so much complexity and there's so much tribal knowledge, the local processes, people, technologies, all of those things. I've always thought that no matter how skilled a person, they'll always have to tend to do an apprenticeship into the new role. So there's never a, well, like 100% of my skills match 100% of this next role that I'm going into. It's just not going to happen. So I just think that inquisitiveness and the ability to learn and research and process information, get up to speed, is more important than a lot of other things. But I'm a little biased.
I think we all are.
Indeed. So are there any other pearls of wisdom for people starting out, either on the recruiter or on the side of the applicant or the employers, that you'd like to call out?
No, I think I've covered it quite well there. I think, you know, from the employer and the applicant perspective, like I say, partnering or approaching a specialist within your niche is going to give you a greater insight, is going to give you a greater insight very often also in terms of jobs that haven't even been advertised. This is something which does happen a lot, where, again, as I mentioned, some, you know, one of the issues from our perspective in terms of job boards was the volume of irrelevant applications. Clients are also aware of that too.
Actually, have you heard of a book called What Color Is Your Parachute?
I have. I've got it.
Yeah.
I haven't actually read much of it.
Yeah, one of the earlier parts of it, one of the earlier principles about in it is, I think it's like the inverted pyramid, and of the 100% of jobs that actually are available on the market, only maybe 10% get down to actually being made available on LinkedIn or any of the other job boards. But there are a number of different other layers in the hierarchy, if I recall correctly, and those are what you just referred to then, and it's through your network is probably your first point of call. If you can't find somebody in your database, spread the wings out to the network. If not out to the network, then maybe then place a job ad or something like that. But so many jobs never even make it to a job board for people to apply to.
Well, that's why you need to partner with the likes of a niche recruiter, possibly myself.
Exactly.
You have that knowledge and you'll know who's hiring.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant. So what a great recap. So, yeah, where can people find you, Michael?
Well, on LinkedIn, I am at Michael Jones. Under the
that might be a hard one to find.
Yeah, very, very vanilla Welsh name, unfortunately. I'm really not sure how best to put that across. I do actually run the charging rating and policy control group on LinkedIn as well. So that's another option. But if you don't see my daily posts, I'd be quite surprised if you're in the OSS space.
Yeah, that's a valid point. So that's definitely where I came across you, is through LinkedIn and the posts that you put out. So yeah, I guess maybe it's Michael Jones at Analytica that might find you specifically there on LinkedIn.
Closely, yeah. Michael at analytica-resources.com.
There you go. Fantastic. And any of the other socials?
Unfortunately, not.
Yeah. LinkedIn's doing the job for you.
I've actually been quite, because we spend a lot of our time, I think, on social media during the course of the working day, I tended to actually have a little bit of the evenings are actually switched off, which is quite good.
Fantastic. All right. So thank you very much, Michael, for being the guest on the Passionate About OSS podcast today. I've found the insights that you've given have been really, really eye-opening, certainly in some of those cases and some of the anecdotes. So, yeah, I look forward to having further chats in the future. And thank you also for the audience for dropping by. Look forward to introducing the next one in a couple of weeks.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Very much appreciated.
Thanks for listening to the Passionate About OSS podcast. You can find more episodes, more than 2,500 blogs, and our contact details over at passionateaboutoss.com.